Thanks so much. And I'll remind you all, we're being recorded. So if you speak, please identify yourselves. And Rose, if you could take role for us.
Rich Conklin,
I'm present.
Miss Fleming,
Present.
Judge Bradshaw,
Present.
Judge Clark, Judge Amity, Judge Gabe,
Present.
Judge Gaddy, Judge Jessner.
She's, I see her.
Sorry,
There she is.
here.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Judge Kamakarian. He informed us he may be late today, but he will be joining us later. Judge Kelly.
Here.
Thank you. Judge Reinhardt.
Present.
Thank you. Judge Rogan.
Here.
Judge Sandhu. Miss Cameron.
Present.
Mr. Finke.
Here.
Mr. Harrigan.
Here.
Mr. Landry.
Here.
Mr. Parker.
Here.
Mr. Riley. He may be joining us late today. Mr. Roddy.
Here.
Mr. Rule.
Here.
Mr. Slayton.
Here.
Ms. Turner.
Here.
Mr. Yamasaki.
Yes, good afternoon, present.
And our advisory member, Mr. Theodorovich.
I'm here.
And then our liaison member, Judge Awani. Thank you.
I see Judge Getty's joined us. So Judge Getty will show. There you are. Thank you. Judge Clark, Judge Amity, I don't see you yet. Judge Sandhu and Brandon Riley. I'm sure they'll join us shortly. Okay, so just a few brief procedural matters, though equally important. The first is to approve the minutes of our April 16th meeting. They're included in materials at page 4. Assuming you folks have had the opportunity to review those minutes, I'll entertain a motion to approve with a second.
Turner moves approval.
Thank you.
Rule second.
Moved and second that the minutes from that meeting be approved. Any opposition? And hearing and seeing none, I'll deem the minutes unanimously approved. Folks, we did receive public comment that's been distributed to all of you. It's in letter form. We'll be addressing how public comment will be received for future meetings at our closed session. But this public comment has been received and has been distributed to all members for their consideration. And we appreciate that public comment.
Judge Conklin, I apologize for being late. There was a typo on the minutes on page 5. Action item number 2, I think it's the delegation of authority as opposed to key delegation.
So ordered.
So anyway, I just wanted to clarify that.
I would have never caught that, David. Thank you. So the minutes are approved with that interlineation of the letter T to make it make sense. Thanks, David. All right. So we have a full agenda for today's meetings. We have 4 discussion items in our open meeting and 1 informational item that will relate directly to our upcoming meeting in 2 weeks, May 22nd. I know this is a busy time for all, but I know you all recognize, given the pending budget, that this is when TICBAC is at its busiest and, in my opinion, at its strength. So I appreciate that from all of you. The first item on our agenda today will be to address the AB 1058 Child Support Commissioner and Family Law Facilitator Program funding for fiscal year 25-26. That is an action item. Wally Roberts, a supervising attorney for the JC Center for Families, Children, and Courts, is with us. We'll consider here the allocations for the Child Support Commissioner and Family Law Facilitator as noted. And Lolly, I will turn it over to you for your presentation. Thank you.
Thank you. So as Judge Conklin said, we are asking for approval of our annual funding allocation for the Child Support Commissioners and Family Law Facilitators. I just wanted to make sure that everyone's aware that there is no change in our annual funding this year. What has changed is that we've refreshed the data in our funding methodology. And so some courts will be receiving either slightly higher or slightly lower amounts than they have in previous years. However, we do place a 5% cap on those changes. So any impacts are minimal. The exact amounts being allocated to each court are contained in pages 9 and 10 of the handout for this meeting. And so I'm not going to reiterate those amounts, but I am available to answer any questions you may have.
Molly, thanks so much. Very succinct and thorough. We appreciate that. The recommendations that we're being asked to approve are set forth on page 8, and they've been previously summarized. So I will open it up to questions, and if not, a motion to approve.
I'll move for approval. This is David Slayton.
David, thank you. Is there a second?
Brandon seconds.
I think I heard Brandon.
Landry.
Well, sorry. Sorry, Sean. Moved and seconded that the recommendation set forth at page 8 be approved. It's now a pending motion before this committee. Any additional discussions or concerns about the recommendation? Hearing and seeing none, I'll follow our standard practice and ask if there is any opposition to the recommendations as set forth. Don't see any, don't hear any. I'll therefore deem the recommendations at page 8, recommendations 1 and 2, unanimously approved. Wally, don't mistake our brevity for our lack of appreciation for your work. This is like any other item, very significant. It's been approved unanimously. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Judge Conklin?
I see you, David. You're welcome, and we're marking you present.
Want you to make sure I know I'm here.
Well, we always do. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right. We're now turning to item 2 on our action agenda. Similarly, this is a request to consider allocations. This is obviously from a different funding source and a need. That's court-appointed juvenile dependency council funding for FY25-26. It's page 11 of your materials. The ultimate recommendation is set forth at page, I believe it's page 12 of your materials. It is. Kelly is here with us. She's a supervising analyst from Judicial Counsel Center, again, for families, children in the courts. And I will turn it over to her or Lolly, are you doing this one?
I have this one, Judge Conklin.
Okay, great. Thanks. Sorry, I've seen too many cameras. Go ahead. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Judge Conklin and members of the committee. I'm Kelly Meelipe, supervising analyst with the Center for Families, Children, and the Courts. And as Judge Conklin indicated for your consideration today, I present the recommended fiscal year 25-26 court-appointed juvenile dependency council funding allocations for the trial courts. These are annual allocations that are considered by the Judicial Council each year at its July meeting. The recommended allocations shown at Attachment 2A are based on the $186.7 million included in the annual budget to support court-appointed dependency counsel and were established using the funding methodologies approved by the Judicial Council in 2016 and amended in 2022. The key factors that are used in the methodology have not changed and are for each court a 3-year rolling average of original dependency filings, a 3-year rolling average of the number of children in foster care, current county council salaries at the median of the first 2 salary ranges reported by counties, and the Bureau of Labor Statistics current index. In addition, as you are aware, the funding methodology also includes several adjustments for small courts to ensure that small courts have adequate funding to meet their needs. Those small court adjustments include suspending reallocation related budget reductions for the smallest courts with caseloads under 200, adjusting the local economic index for the small courts with dependency caseloads under 400, and adjusting funding for all large courts to offset the costs for small court funding. And with that, that completes my presentation, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
And likewise, Kelly, thanks so much. We appreciate your brevity and your thoroughness. At the same time, the recommendations, as I said, are set forth at page 12. That's to approve the allocations as set forth in the charts. I'd invite any questions for Kelly or a motion. David, your hand's up. Go ahead, David Slayton.
Yes, thanks. I know we received public comment about this. I want to acknowledge that I'm sure all of us read that. And I point out something I think I pointed out last year when we got public comment, which is that the funding for this item, statewide funding for this item, has been frozen for now for the fourth year in a row, which I think, you know, obviously is impacting the amount of money that the branch has to distribute across the state. And so to those programs that are receiving less funding, obviously, when there's no more funding to give, the formula works its way as it should. I know that the commenters are expressing discussions about the formula itself. I'm curious, maybe for Kelly, whether or not that formula has been looked at recently, and if there's any consideration for, you know, I know there's some concern about the caseloads and other things. I'm just curious when the last time we looked at that formula was.
Thank you, Mr. Slayton. So the formula, we have not done any type of amendment to the formula in a while, and but we have been putting in a BCC for the last couple of years to take a look at, to do a workload study, to do a comprehensive study on the dependency workload. And part of that would also be looking at caseloads. Unfortunately, it hasn't been moved forward for the past 2 years, but as you may be aware, there is going to be further consideration by JBBC soon, but we have not made any changes to the current funding methodology again since it was amended in 2022.
And Kim Turner, I see your, did that answer your question?
Yes, very helpful. Thank you very much. If I can just make one more point, I think it's worth knowing. I know every court, we could look at, you know, all the different courts across the state. I obviously have at my fingertips the LA numbers. And I'll just point out that the last 2 years, there have been almost 5% decreases in funding. I know there's reasons for that based upon caseload and other things, but obviously I know that has a significant impact on the providers. And so looking at the formula and thinking about the overall funding, I think is something we should keep at front of our minds. So thanks for the answering the question. I appreciate it.
Thank you, David. Appreciate that. Kim Turner, your hands up.
Yes, I just had a question for Kelly. So I'm looking at attachment 2B, where you make the adjustment for small court increases with BLS adjustment, which is in column N. And I'm curious, so I know you said in your remarks that, you know, that additional courts were kind of added to that calculation because of the decline in filings and so forth. But I'm looking, you know, of course, we always, it's habit to look at your own court line first, even though Judge Conklin always asks us. But I would say from looking at my own court's line, our funding need appears to be $666,000. But under this BLS adjustment for a small court, we get a little more money than even our need reflects. So I'm wondering if that's intentional or if that's an oversight in the way the model is built, or why would a court receive more funding for this program than its judicial or than its need represents? It's right. Not a lot more, but it is a little more. So just curious.
Right. And that's exactly, you know, we tried to identify in the footnote that, you know, because even because of downward trends in filings, the small court adjustments do indeed, they have applied to more courts. So some small courts, because of the way the funding methodology is currently, are receiving increased funding despite drops in caseloads. And that is something that we are aware of.
No, and I'm certainly grateful for the additional funding. I'm just concerned about the small amount of funding over and above our need, which is reflected in column L. So I see that a number of the courts that are getting this adjustment are getting an adjustment right up to the point of their need. But in my case, in Mendocino's case, we're getting a few more dollars than even our need represents by $12,000 additional dollars, for example. So I just am curious about if whether that's a flaw in the funding model, or, you know, I realize, you know, these are big algorithmic, you know, amazing things that you guys are doing with spreadsheets. But I'm just curious about whether or not this is you know, just how the numbers fell this year, or this is an intentional, you know, sort of little bonus to a few of the smaller courts that are getting this small court adjustment.
Yeah, this is just how the numbers fell this year. I am also happy just to take a look, take a little bit of more time to look deeper back into it, and I can circle back to you or the committee if there's further questions about it.
Great. Thank you, Kelly. And really, thanks for all your work on this. And I also want to acknowledge what David said about the letter from the Juvenile Dependency Council panels and individual attorneys. I think this is, you know, I've been involved in the draft program since it was started back in like 2003 or something like that, and have, you know, this has been a constant drumbeat that, you know, the model needs to be reviewed, that the numbers are too high. And that I'm all of that, of course, is funding related, but I think there's always an opportunity to at least present what the ideal caseload size would be based on, you know, not just the metrics that we have in California, but there are metrics across the nation as to how many cases an attorney can legitimately handle, competently handle in the course of, you know, in the course of a contract. So just want to reiterate, as David did more eloquently than I did, that than I am, that this is something that I think needs to be examined, and I hope is being examined again by your committee.
Thanks, Kim. Much appreciated. Chris Rule, I see your hands up.
Yes, thank you, Judge, and thank you, Kelly. I also wanted to acknowledge the public comment that was submitted today. I appreciate that. And also really make the point of how the very small courts, I'm speaking now especially like two-judge courts, for example, in California, of which there are 15, despite, and especially those I think that don't benefit from being part of the draft program that Kim Turner just mentioned, really, really struggle to find dependency counsel. And it's a combination, you know, despite, and we really appreciate the adjustments that are made for small courts to accommodate small court needs, but even with those, we struggle mightily from day to day and week to week to retain sufficient numbers of dependency counsel, especially for conflict cases, because of our, you know, we have to backfill even the money that we do receive and supplement that to try and get the counsel that we need to cover these cases. And in many cases, we're not able to. And partly that's because of competition that we struggle to pay competitive rates to the attorneys who are available, the few attorneys that are available to do this work. So I just wanted to add that comment and note to this discussion. Thank you.
All valid concerns and comments. Thanks so much to all of you. I don't see any other hands up. Kelly, thanks so much. I would now call for a motion to approve the recommendations at page 12.
This is Kim Turner. I move approval.
Thank you. Is there a second?
Yamasaki seconds.
I heard David Yamasaki first, though Judge Rogan, I appreciate your, I think you were the one trying to jump in there. Moved and seconded, and as I call for this vote, I want to acknowledge the valid concern set forth by everybody. It doesn't mean this is not an ongoing issue and something that is continuous efforts are being made to address those concerns. With that, is there any opposition to the recommendation set forth at page 12? Waited, I see none, I hear none. I'll deem that recommendation unanimously approved. I should clarify for this recommendation, for any of these, you all see in your materials that bold print that these allocations are updated based upon technical adjustments and are more importantly contingent on funding being included in the budget that's going to be enacted for 25-26, which we'll find out soon enough. So just always that caveat as we move through these numbers. They most likely will change given those factors. But thank you very much, Kelly. Much appreciated. That takes us to item number three, pretrial release program allocations for 25-26. Deidre Benedict is here from the Judicial Council of Criminal Justice Services to consider these allocations set forth beginning at, page 15 of your material, and the ultimate recommendations, I believe, are at page 16. So with that, Deidre.
Thank you, Judge Conklin, and thank you, members of the Trial Court Budget Advisory Committee. This is the fifth year of the pretrial release program and the fifth year that I've brought staff recommendations for this year for fiscal year 25-26. Beginning with the Budget Act of 2021, $70 million was allocated for funding for all trial courts. The methodology for this disbursement is actually contained within the legislation, and it's to be distributed by the percentage of the total population of 18 to 24-year-olds in that county. So every year we look at the census and we make some adjustments. We have done that today. You'll find the attachment 3A at page 18. This year there are very minor differences. They go from $40 up to $374,000. And I'm sorry, David, but that is your county, of course. But in addition to the allocation, staff always recommends a funding floor as well for small and medium-sized courts. And we made a promise to you all that we would review that every year. Every year we reach out to every small county that's been impacted by the funding floor. We look at their spending, we look at what their need is for the upcoming year and ask them what they think they will need. So we come with a new recommendation for continuing the funding floor. 20 courts are at the full funding floor of $200,000. One court would receive 150, one court 125, and one court 25,000. So I am happy to answer any questions, but we would hope you would take this recommendation forward. Thank you.
Deidre, thanks so much. Those recommendations that she just referred to are at page 16 of the materials. But as Deidre's disinvited, any questions or concerns about this allocation for retrial? Kim, I see your hand up. Turner, go ahead. You're muted.
Sorry, I'm always a squeaky wheel on these meetings, but I did want to, first of all, thank Deidre and acknowledge that I'm glad to see that your office is now doing a little bit of a deeper dive into the funding floor courts, because I think there is, as you mentioned in your report, this is year five of the pretrial program. And when this program started, 200,000 was established as the funding floor, and that's been in place now for 5 years. And I'm wondering, I'm not suggesting that we do anything for the 25-26 allocations, but I'm wondering if there's an opportunity maybe for the following year to take a more nuanced look at the funding floor courts to determine, you know, whether or not, those that still claim, and I'm sure rightfully so, that they need $200,000. Those courts are often two judge courts. My court is an 8-judge court, and I also get $200,000. And I'm not speaking for my own court. I'm speaking for all of those small, medium courts that are kind of in the same bracket that I am. I just think that there's an opportunity to maybe take a look at not just asking the courts for anecdotal information or narrative information on what they think they need, but actually looking at the data that's been provided, because I'm sure you've been amassing an enormous amount of data over the last 5 years, and seeing if there's another way that we can actually look at those allocations in perhaps a different way.
Yes, thank you. And in addition to the anecdotal information we get from the courts, we do get quarterly progress reports that describe the activities they're taking. We also have an annual budget that each court is required to prepare that also outlines not only the court's portion, but the pretrial service provider who gets the majority of the funding. 70% at least of each county's allocation goes to the pretrial service provider. We also look at actual spend. So that is part of what we look at and evaluate before we talk with the court. And then we talk with them about what they anticipate going forward in the next year. So I wholeheartedly agree, and we will continue to do that work. I will also say, much like the previous program, this has been a static pot of funding. Entering our 5 year, we remain at the same amount. And I know as budgets get tight, everyone starts to see where we can, pull change out of the sofa. But we will continue to look very carefully at this and make allocation recommendations as needed.
Thank you so much.
Kim, that answers your question?
It does.
Great, thanks so much. Anybody else, any other questions for Deidre before I call for a motion?
No question, Judge Conklin. I just wanted to commend Deidre for her selection of the font size for the chart.
I agree, David. Good point.
we all are getting to the point of needing it, so thank you.
I don't know if those other charts could get any smaller, but it's nice to actually see bigger numbers here. Thank you. All right. With that important comment as well, is there a motion to approve the recommendations as set forth at page 16 of the materials?
I'll move to approve, judges. Chad.
Chad, thanks so much. Is there a second?
Yeah,
we're sorry.
I heard voices, and I'll just deem a second. Moved and seconded that the motion recommendations be approved. Now there's a pending motion. Any further questions or comments? And if not, any opposition? Seeing none, I'll deem this item as well unanimously approved. Deidre, as always, good to see you. Thanks so much. Appreciate it. And our final action item for today is item number 4, that starts at page, 20 of your material, the recommendations at page 21. And this is for court reporter allocations for fiscal year 25-26 to increase the number of court reporters in family law and civil law case types. Marshall, are you with us? There we go. I'll turn it over to you. Thank you so much.
Good afternoon, Trial Court Budget Advisory Committee. As Judge Conklin said, I'm Marshall Kamian. I'm a Judicial Counsel Policy and Research. Thanks for having me today. I'm here to present to you for your consideration the proposed fiscal year 2025-26 allocations for the $30 million included in the proposed 2025-26 governor's budget to increase the number of court reporters in family law and civil law case types. The allocation amounts detailed in the report may look familiar to you as they are all the same allocation amounts that were approved last year. As mentioned in the report, the methodology hasn't changed since the council approved the methodology in January 2022, and the $30 million has been an ongoing funding amount. And just as a quick recap, but detailed in your report about how this methodology works is that using the assessed judicial needs data, we identify the proportion of judicial workload for non-criminal need by court. We apply the $25,000 funding floor to all courts. And then after we apply that funding floor, allocate the remaining money proportionally to all the other courts based on their non-criminal judicial need. And this allocation in the funding is allocated in one lump sum. One thing to note is that more recent assessed judicial needs data is still being worked on and won't be ready until later this year or next year. So these allocations are based on the 2022 assessed judicial needs data. The absence of new data is why there are no changes to the allocation methodology and amounts from last year. You also may have seen at the most recent Judicial Council meeting that the Judicial Council approved an updated model for measuring court workload and assessing staffing needs. This data is separate and apart from the judicial needs data that is used to allocate this money. And so with that, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Excellent presentation, Marshall. Thank you. Any questions for Marshall about this final action item? I don't see Kim Turner's hand up, so, but I do see Judge Clark. Go ahead. Just teasing you, Kim. Judge, go ahead.
I apologize for being late. I just want to say, I do think there needs to be a correction to a typo in the recommendation because it says $30 million for court reports and it should be reporters. So before the motion is made, the typo should be corrected.
Good catch. So let's make sure that happens. I'm sure Rose is right on that, but we'll again, by interlineation, change that to approve the FY25-26 allocation for $30 million for court reporters on a proportional basis. Judge, thanks for catching that. Any others? Seeing none, hearing none, is there a motion to approve the recommendation?
Yamasaki moves.
David, thank you. A second?
Gabe, second.
Thank you, Judge Gabe. Moved and seconded the recommendation be approved. It's open for discussion. And seeing none or hearing no further discussion, any opposition? Doesn't appear to be any opposition. On behalf of the entire committee, I'll deem this recommendation as well unanimously approved. To all four of our those folks who gave presentations today, thanks so much. We really appreciate it. And we now move into our informational item. I want to preface this discussion with, I hope you all saw, but just before the meeting started, a PowerPoint was posted. It's both available on the TICBAC website, but also by email, so you all should have it. This is the PowerPoint that will be presented in this informational item. We're going to hear from Leah Rose Goodwin. It's always great to hear from Leah. She's our, as we all know, the chief of the data and analytics officer for Judicial Council, and Kristen Greenaway is a manager. So Zlatko's going to be assist with this, as is Oksana. And this is essentially an update of the resource study model that was approved by the council at its April meeting. So this is significant work for us. This is something that we will closely ponder and consider at our May 22nd meeting. For lack of a better way to say it, that's when we'll get into the meat of this item. As far as an action item at that time, we'll have data presented to us. We'll have numbers. But this today we thought was most appropriate to start this discussion with the experts, as I sometimes describe the pros from Dover, to help us understand what the council just did, what the resource assessment study model approved by them does as far as moving forward and the impact that it will have. So we're going to hear this update, and then we'll have plenty of time for discussion today, again reminding you that the actual numbers and consideration of requests to approve those will come at our May 22nd meeting. With that, Leah and others, the show is yours.
Well, thank you, Judge Conklin. And normally this would be Kristen Greenaway's presentation, but she was unexpectedly out ill today. So I am filling in for her. We'll do my best to do so. And you are right. We are recapping a bit our presentation that was made at the council a couple of weeks ago concerning the model. And, you know, I just want to say too, in terms of the timing, we started this study update in 2023, and I'll explain a little bit about timing, but it is a bit like landing a big ship, and it does, we did conclude our work, I know, fairly close to the time, very close to the time when you folks are considering allocations. So this is hot off the press, and happy to go through and explain or go through the presentation, and I'll take some time for questions throughout. And then after I conclude going through the RAS model presentation, Zlatko and his team will take over and talk a little bit more about the workload formula. So one thing I'm not good at doing is talking and trying to find the share screen at the same time. So give me just a second to get a little...
There you go.
Oh, Rose, you're going to put it up? Okay, great. Then I'll let you drive it. That works with me.
Sounds good.
Fantastic. Okay. So if we go to the next slide, I'm going to just, again, talk a little bit about the update that was made at the council meeting. And if you were listening to the meeting, you'd know that the council had approved the updated case weights and other model parameters, all based on a 2024 time study in the courts, and as well as the year value was updated. And we also have a new three-year average of filings data. So we'll walk through those items now. And if I can get Rose to switch over to the next slide. I'm going to give a brief recap. I feel so bad. Some of you have heard me say this year after year. I apologize. So you can... but I felt it was important to cover some ground again for those who might be newer to the model. The RAS model, the Resource Assessment Study Model, is the model that is used to assess resource need in our trial courts. And it essentially assigns weights to different cases based on the amount of workload that those cases take. This methodology has been around a long time. The National Center for State Courts originated it many, many years ago, more than 40, maybe 50 years ago. And we see it used in various applications. It's used to measure court staff time, judicial officer time, even probation officer and district attorney time. Here in California, and turning to the next slide, the council first approved this methodology about 20 years ago. Wow, it's been 20 years ago this year. We have made updates to the model every, the years are delineated here on the slide, so I won't read through them. But an earlier committee that oversaw this work, the Workload Assessment Advisory Committee, recommended that the model be updated about every 5 years. And that's really critical to do that because things change over time. So Rose, to the next slide, please. Over time, we see changes in the volume of cases, the types of cases that courts hear, the complexity associated with these cases. And these, there are differences among courts, and there are differences over time. We see that even courts, two courts that might have very similar volumes of filings, could have different mixes of cases that result in different workload need. So a court, one court may have more felony filings, another court may have more infraction filings, for example, and those differences in mix can result in different workload demands and different resource need. We mitigate some of the change over time by using a three-year average of filings, and that contributes toward one of the principles that will come up later in discussion of the workload formula, that you want to try to tamper down any sort of year-to-year volatility in filings. And that's a particular circumstance that we see in our smaller courts, where you could have one year, you could have 10 juvenile filings, and the next year you could have 15. And while that seems like a very small change, that's a 50% increase in filings from one year to the next. And so using a three-year average helps moderate some of those changes. And on to the next slide, please. There are three main inputs that go into RAS, that three-year average of filings that I just discussed, the case weights that are measuring the time to process different types of cases, and the work year value, which is the amount of time that's available for court staff to do the work. And we use a formula that's, or a calculation that's down here at the bottom of the screen. We essentially multiply that three-year average of filings by the case weight for each case type and divide by the work year value, and we come up with an assessed FTE need that's based on each case type's complexity, the quantity of filings in each case type. All right, how about we go to the next slide, and then I will take a pause for any questions that might have come up so far. But just to recap, again, expressing work resource need as an FTE. And I should say that this is the RAS model is the first step, the originating step, the baseline for the workload formula. And it through a series of conversions that I think Zlatko will go into next, we do that conversion to dollar need in the workload formula. And so let me just stop there for a second and ask if there are any questions about the fundamentals of the RAS model. And then in the next series of slides, I'm going to talk specifically about the 2024 study.
So rather than any broad-based questions about these in particular, just the narrow issue that Leah just noted, any questions about where we are so far? I don't see any hands. I've got a much smaller screen because that PowerPoint's up there. But if anybody has a question I'm not acknowledging, please raise your hand or voice. Otherwise, Leah, you're doing great. Keep going.
Okay, Judge. Thank you. Thanks for that. All right. So on the next slide, I'm going to talk more specifically about the 2024 study. You know, I should say to begin with that this really should, the title of this slide really should read 2022 study. We should have done this study many years ago. Again, we try to update it every 5 years. The previous study was conducted in 2017, and that would have put us on track, or I'm sorry, 2016. That was the actual date of the time study. That would have put us on track for a time study update in 2021. But I don't know about you. I was busy with a lot of other things during then, and the courts specifically had lots going on. It was a terrible time to do a time study. And if a time study is intended to capture the general case processing practices of a court, then 2021 was a terrible time to do that. So the Data Analytics Advisory Committee decided to defer the study update until such time as we were out of the pandemic. And then once the governor lifted the emergency orders and we saw trends in court filings starting to return to normal levels, we thought that it was now time to dip our toe in the water again and do a study update. So I think that's really important to note. The 2024 study reflects close to 8 years of changes in the law, case processing practices, and changes in technology applications since the last study was updated. So we had 19 courts who participated. I really want to thank those courts that participated. This is it's an all-out effort. It requires all case processing staff in a court to participate for a four-week period, logging every work activity that happens in the course of a day, course of a working day. And so you can see from the courts that are listed there, we had a large, healthy sample of court staff in all areas of the state, representing courts of different sizes, courts of different demographic characteristics. And all told, we had over 5,000 people involved in the study contributing data. Many people ask, wow, how can you capture what happens in courts in a four-week period? And part of what we're doing by having 19 courts and 5,000 people in the study is we're trying to ensure that we capture all events and all activities and cases. If it doesn't happen in one court during that four-week period, it will inevitably happen in another court during that period of time. We also account for non-case processing work. So if you have staff who are doing training or administrative work or work that maybe not directly related to a case, maybe they're assisting people at the counter, all of that work is captured. I also want to address another similar issue related to an earlier slide where I mentioned that we use filings as a driver of workload. We have to use filings because it gives us a sense of volume. But that doesn't mean that we are only capturing workload associated with new filings. If there is, for example, a instance of post-dispositional criminal workload where the underlying case originated in the court many years ago, and now the defendant is coming back to seek relief under this new under a new law or statute, that time is still captured in the case weight and is reflected in the updated weights. All right, Rose, will you move to the next slide, please? We capture data for 22 case type categories. New this year, we have captured workload associated with the CARE Act, a new filing type. We were also able to refine and update a preliminary weight that was established for mental health certification. We established that weight on an interim basis a few years back when that workload and those filings started to track in our GPSIS data collection repository, and we needed to come up with an interim weight to measure that workload. Interim weights are definitely a feature of the Data Analytics Advisory Committee. A lot of our work is like painting the Golden Gate Bridge. You finish one end and you turn right around and you start painting again. And inevitably, there's always going to be a new area of work that opens up that doesn't get captured in the time study. And if it appears that that workload is something that can be measured on an interim basis, then there have been times when the Data Analytics Advisory Committee and its predecessor, the Workload Assessment Advisory Committee, has created these interim weights. Another feature of the 2024 study is that we have now approved a consolidated weight to measure infractions cases. In the past, we had two separate infractions case weights that differentiated between courts that had over 100,000 filings per year and courts that had fewer than 100,000 filings. But for this study, we did not see a difference in the workload required to process those infractions dependent on that distinction, based on that distinction. And so what we in talking to courts who were part of the study, we are thinking that in the past, 10, 15 years ago, larger courts might have had access to technology that let them be more efficient with things like scanning. The cost of that technology has come down, is easier, more accessible for other courts to access. And so some of those economies, that differentiation just doesn't exist anymore. And then finally, we have an updated work year value that we proposed to the Judicial Council to reflect the new state holiday, the Juneteenth holiday, and updated leave averages. There was a slight increase in the annual leave. And I'll show that on the next slide just in more detail, because the work year value is right there. Thank you. So the difference by adding that Juneteenth holiday and that additional leave time, it added about 9.75 hours of, or made a difference of that much time. So about a 1% difference in time available to staff, taking the work year value to 97,965 minutes. Okay, on the next slide, please. So just wrapping up a few of the other study findings, I'm sorry. I just want to reiterate to this concept that I discussed earlier about court filings and court workload. I think that was a really interesting point of discussion that we had both at the council meeting presentation and in the Workload Assessment Advisory Committee. Weighted caseload, the benefit of weighted caseload is recognizing that the number of filings or transactions is not the same as court workload. Another thing that we saw was that case complexity has been increasing for many case types. At the council meeting, Judge Heinrichs gave a case study of the domestic violence, the DV-100 process. In that, the DV-100 over the past 20 or so years has changed from a document that was 4 to 5 pages long to one that is now 13 pages long. And while page count alone is not the measure of workload, the number of orders that are available for people to file or request of the court has increased. And the change in the number of orders reflects appropriately public policy decisions that have been put into play to increase victim safety. But those are orders also that require courts to do additional work. And some of the orders manifest into other documents and orders and workload that courts must carry out. So case complexity has changed over time. Courts are having to implement these legislative changes, and we are seeing that in the filings. To the next slide, please, Rose. Thank you. So when we look at some of our workload, I think there's interest in understanding where has the work increased, where has the work changed, what's the relationship between filings workload and weighted caseload. The top half of this chart shows the top 10 or so case types based on volume, filings volume. So infractions dominates. Nearly 60% of the cases that courts work on are infractions. And all other case types added together make up 42% of court work or court transactions. When you look at the lower set of the lower set of bars and the lower pie chart, that now shows the amount of workload in each court, weighted filings. And you'll see that infractions now comes in at about sixth place there. It's the largest by volume, but in terms of workload, it only makes up 8% of court workload. And the most time-intensive or labor-intensive, workload-intensive filing types are felony and family law. Okay, Rose, can you go to the next slide? So just again, I want to, you know, just spend a little last moment here discussing this concept of change in complexity, change in filings. We talked to a lot of courts before, during, and after the study, and also in our Data Analytics Advisory Committee. We heard a lot about post-judgment resentencing. We heard a lot about impact of diversion. We heard that in some, while filings themselves might be down in certain case types like juvenile justice, the cases that remain tend to be those that are more complex and more serious. All right, to the next slide, please, Rose. So I want to give just a quick recap about filings as well. I've been in front of this committee, well, many years ago now, but when we were in the midst of the pandemic, we were trying to understand trends in court workload. And the story now is starting to shift. After several years of watching the filings decline and decline through the pandemic period, we've seen 2 years in a row of growth. From last year, compared to last year, filings are up 8%. And compared to the year before that, they were up 2%. And then going to the next slide, Rose. Again, I mentioned that we use a three-year average of filings in the RAS FTE need that's then used in the workload formula. And similarly, we see an increase of 3% in that three-year average of filings. So filings are trending upward. And then to the next, Rose. Zlatka is going to go into more detail about the workload formula. But another thing I wanted to mention is that the changes in the RAS FTE need that we've observed over time have been in the last 5 years have really reflected the pandemic era. So in this chart, the change in the RAS need, the staff need, going through last year's computation, the 24-25 computation, the RAS need has reflected that change in the decline in filings due to the pandemic. Again, we're using a three-year average. So the pandemic era, you know, featured widely in our data, but was tamped down by use of that average. So the blue bars here show that change in FTE need from the prior year. So if I read the first set of bar charts, in 2021, fiscal year 2021, the RAS FTE need increased by 2% compared to the previous year. Again, looking at the blue chart, the blue bars, in 21-22, the RAS FTE need also increased 2%, just under 2%. In that year as well. The changes in the RAS FTE need don't always track with the changes in the workload formula. The formula has many other components that go into it, as Laka will describe. And so the change in workload formula need can vary from RAS. And I think this is where we hand off the baton, Zlatko, and you're gonna talk a little bit more about some of those, about the formula, the policy, and some of the changes.
So Zlatko is going to take over now. Appreciate everybody hanging in there for this. I think the one thing I would emphasize from all of those comments is what we're contemplating here, folks, is 8 years of change.
Yeah. So I have one more Zlatko's slide.
Going to highlight
There's
that.
A couple more slides that Leah has.
I'm so sorry. I missed the cue. Judge Conklin, you did such a nice introduction, and I apologize. I forgot that I had another something to say. But let me just highlight, yes, thank you. 8 years of changes. I think that's really important to recognize. The committee talked a lot about the changes in RAS FTE need. I'm sorry, the changes in the case weights that go into the RAS FTE need, and spent a lot of time examining and asking staff to go back and validate the weights, especially where there were changes in weights. And secondly, there was a second area of committee discussion as we were wrapping up the study was understanding that impact of authorized judicial positions to a court workload need. That's actually one of the adjustment request process requests that we have received and the committee will be considering. So, you know, how does that play into court workload need?
Zlatko?
There's one more slide.
We're almost there. Yeah. I'm sorry, Judge. I dropped everything on my desk and my slides got a little bit out of order. So I am about to finish and let Zlatko take over. But I thought I would show also the slide that we showed at the council meeting, which is a comparison of the weights in 2025 to the weights as they were in 2017. And Judge Conklin, to your point, these are 8 years of difference that we're seeing between these weights. And you know, I'll go back to the Golden Gate Bridge. The committee, it feels very confident about the work that was done to get to the weights, the validation period with courts, working with NCSC. But that's not to say that the committee is going to not just like the Golden Gate Bridge, turn around and you know, be thinking again about weights. One area of committee discussion was, you know, was of course making sure that we're very clear on weights and the changes in weights from the previous study period. The committee also oversees the SB 154 operational metrics work. And one of the things that I think ties in nicely is looking at where courts appear to be spending more time than they did in the previous study and how that might connect with operational metrics and the amount of cases that are disposed within certain time frames. So we will continue to review the model and make adjustments as needed. And now for sure, Judge Conklin, I'm done and I'm gonna turn it over to Zlatko. But I will take a question or two if there's something that was unclear.
Great, thanks for remaining with us for those purposes. I'm sure there will be, Zlatko.
Yes, thank you, Judge, and thank you, Leah. I think what I wanna start off with is how important this change is. It's a critical change and necessary change in terms of the case weights, but it is a significant change. And in prior years, when there's been these kinds of changes, there's been a bit of an understanding, absorption, discussion process. And we want to kind of address that a little bit when we get to the end of the conversation. But before we do that, I want to let you know about sort of how we, and when I say we, the committee and the council uses the outputs from RAS into what we call the workload formula policy. Because I think people think there's some sort of black box that everything just goes into and things come out. And while there is some, you know, lots of spreadsheets and things like that, first and foremost, there is the policy of what we're doing. And so just to sort of remind folks from prior years, and I think we've gone over this a bit, but it's in our resource document that sort of outlines the history of all this. But we all know coming out of Trial Court Funding Act, funding was based on historical levels. And we realized that, you know, as also the prodding of the administration to look at equity, we wanted to see what we were going to do with sort of determining where courts were in terms of their funding levels. We instituted WAFL. That in and of itself, the committee worked before it was the tick back, it was the Trial Court Budget Working Group. We worked many months on it and then spent many months working with the courts to understand it. And we laid that out with our partners. And so it was a really slow process in this significant change. And I'm sort of likening it to where we are now, which is after 8 years of the case weights being in place, we're now considering, you know, how that might be used in our budgeting. But again, that's a significant change. Come around in 18-19, again, lots of work, lots of meetings, lots of sort of slow and deliberate conversations within the tick back, and lots of input in public meetings in which folks could absorb and understand the implications of the movement. And since then, we you know that the TICBAC and FMS, they go through an annual process of looking at, you know, sort of parking lot issues. And there's been continued refinements of that model. So again, it's a policy first and foremost about how we achieve the objectives of equity, moving away from the historical funding models that came out of the TROCR Funding Act. So next slide. So one thing we want to always remind folks is the aspect of it's not just equity that we focus on. It's also volatility, stability, and predictability. And changes like this can impact what is our attempts to minimize the volatility, the stability, and the predictability with this kind of change. And so that's been an important focus of ours that we've heard this committee and FMS talk about over the last 6 months about the aspect of volatility and stability and predictability. Obviously, there's the idea of the third bullet, a time for adjustment and adaptation. The data that we've been presented with, I think we're going to suggest that it needs time to be adapted to and understood. And to the extent that there's needed adjustments, that those can be fed back to and looked at by DAC, as Leah suggested. And obviously, in any application of policy, we need to see what that means from a local court perspective and the budget. Next slide, please. And I think that, again, and you'll see later on in the slides, and what we're suggesting here as far as how we use the updated case weights is we want to make sure that there is transparency in this. And for us, having a more thoughtful approach to the application of the case weights to the workload formula policies will be something that's really important for us. So next slide, please. So as Leah's described, RAS generates FTEs. And that's an important part of what we do, because then it becomes we have to convert that to something. Because just in and of itself, the RAS and the case weights aren't really a tangible operational reflection. They can tell you what you feel and what you see in terms of the time it takes and the complexity of the cases. But what does that mean to you in that conversion, moving from the case weights being this many minutes? It's how many people are needed. And then ultimately, what does that relate in terms of your funding need? And so what's important is, as Leah's described, we use, her team uses the three-year filings averages. We provide input as it relates to salaries and benefits, OE&E. There's the Bureau of Labor Statistics factors that are in there. And those are ever growing outside of the filings. We've talked about, Leah talked about the filings declining, and that didn't mean that necessarily the workload formula output in terms of dollars and the need is a one-for-one. In fact, there were, as she showed you, there are circumstances when OE&E and salary, which naturally grow every year, are going to make each person, each FTE, more expensive, even if there was no change in the FTEs. But in this year, we have some filing increases that are going to conceptually add to the needed staff, and those costs, are sort of compounded. And so, again, it's when you finally get to see sort of the dollar impact that you really maybe things start to absorb it. And then we're talking about a significant change in the case weights that could have a sort of a detrimental impact on the goal of stability, predictability, and volatility for us. But ultimately, yes, the FTEs is converted to the dollars that they described. And then its application and the workload formula calculations can vary based on budget circumstances. So let's just, on the next slide, we just remind folks of what we look at. What is our sort of driving figure for everything is, what is our workload formula allocation, those resources that are available, over the need. And the need is driven by the math that I just described on the prior slide. And so without accounting for the 24-25 workload formula need was at 91%, the need is at 2.7, the allocation is 2.5, saying that we're funded at 91.3%. Well, we all have been feeling that that's not enough. And we definitely have been, identified through the updated case weights that there is more work than we were capturing in the workload formula need previously. So next slide, please. So one thing we want to talk about is that the workload formula is not applied every year in and of itself. It occurs when there are certain budget circumstances. So in a situation where we aren't getting new money, there isn't a funding reduction, and we're not in that second year of no new money, where we're doing this equity-based reallocation, the workload formula need and those values are information, but they don't actually impact your allocations unless, again, the budget circumstances necessitate its application. So if it weren't for the fact that we were considering and recommending a reallocation this year, the new case weights and the resultant workload formula calculations would, again, not be influencing your allocations. But with this equity-based reallocation that is being considered by the council, there will be the potentially impacts on here because of the new case weights. So they're significant changes. We're really concerned about what that might mean in terms of the volatility, the predictability, and the stability of your allocations. That next slide, please. We're recommending that they continue to use the case weights that were existing in 2017, but updating for everything else, filings, salaries, OE&E, BLS, all those other factors be used so that there is time to adapt and adjust and sort of absorb the impact of the information that's impacted by the new case weights. And so there's really, I think, a critical moment here where we want to make a choice about what kind of allocation approach do we want to take. And we believe that given the significant change that the new case weights are bringing, that using the existing case weight, it makes sense so that there's time for the allocations to be sort of reflective of this absorbed information. But otherwise, we have the $55 million baseline reduction that's already been addressed. We have this equity-based reallocation. And next slide, please. We have those other allocations that are not tied to the workload formula and its policies as it relates to the operational funding increases, as well as the court benefits. And so hopefully the next slide, please. When we get to the May revision a week from today, those monies will still be there for us. But this is all a sort of important foundation for us as we head to the May 22nd meeting, is that these aren't just your sort of standard updates that have occurred over the last 7 years. This is substantial potential change that we believe makes more sense to sort of defer and let the committee, let the courts as a whole really understand the implications of the impact of the updated case weights on their position within the overall workload formula calculations. I think that is the end of the slide.
So I want to thank both of you for an excellent presentation. I know there's some hands up and we're going to talk about this, but let me preface this with a few comments. A couple things. So I'm going to analogize to the way to presenting this to a jury from a judge's perspective. And we talk about opening statements and closing statements or arguments. This is the opening statement. This is what we, as we say to a jury, this is what we expect the evidence will show. The closing summary or argument is going to be at the meeting 2 weeks from tomorrow, the May 22nd meeting, where we're going to get down to raw numbers. So from a judge's perspective, that's what we're looking at. I don't mean to oversimplify it. There was a couple, I thought, key concepts as Leah moved through this and Zlatko moved through this, and I know I'm repeating myself, but one of them is, this is 8 years of change, folks. This is a necessary study. It was delayed for appropriate reasons, but over the past 8 years, if I ask all the judges to speak here, we'd be on this call for the next 3 hours about how our work has changed over the past 3 years and the additional work we've been asked to complete. If I asked the CEOs to do the same thing, they'd probably be here for 3 weeks. So this is a significant movement. Zlatko's, I thought, quote of the day was, absorb and understand the implications of the movement. That's what we need time to do. I'm just stating facts, folks. The next fiscal year begins in less than 2 months. We can boil it down to less than 60 days. And if we moved forward now with the impact of what this new workload study shows, our ultimate pillars or goals of stability and predictability would evaporate for the courts that are impacted. It's going to impact us, but as we will see, the time that we're talking about is going to be necessary to allow. And again, I know I'm talking about a lot of statements were made here. I think Leah said it, this ship to change course or to adjust its course. You can't do it in a matter of, I think it would be 47 or 48 days. So I've said enough. I think you all know where we're going. You will see numbers. These are just once again being vetted as carefully as they can be. They'll be made available in more than a timely basis for our May 22nd meeting. And with that, I see hands and Kim, there you are. Thank you so much. You're first up, and then Judge Getty, I see yours, and any hands after that. I see Chris Rules. We'll get to all of you. We've got at least 20 minutes. Kim?
So just quickly, I think you answered my question, Judge Conklin. We will see sort of the A-B comparison as to what would happen if we adopted the new RAS figures from this new study versus what those numbers look like using the 2017 data. Is that correct?
Yeah, but let me correct, because if I understood what you just said, you said if we adopted, the council has adopted.
No, I misspoke. No, I agree with that. But I'm surmising from what all of you are saying that the numbers would so radically change the funding for the courts based on the new
Go ahead.
Is that there's also another consideration, and it's a public meeting, is before we go and put out the new numbers, there's also external, and I'm talking about with the new case weights, mm-hmm. we definitely will be running it with the old case weights, but there's other considerations in terms of our external partners. And mm-hmm. if there are some things that need refinement with what we've done, if we go out with that number that you've described, and it is a substantial number that needs to be managed, we have to be thoughtful about what that means to our Department of Finance and our governor's staff and the legislature in them seeing this. So I think that the idea of digesting and is not that will then sort of presuppose that that's the right place. And my recommendation to the committee is that we need to deliberate on that. And the courts as a whole, not just this committee, because this isn't just a tick back issue. This is the entire court, all 58 courts needing and having time to look at this and understand it. Yes, the DAC did a great job in what they were doing, but now we need to really work through what does that mean? And I just lean on, Kim, you were with me, and as was David and others back in our WAFM days when we went, we roadshowed this. We gave yes. folks time to digest it before we gave people the final numbers. And I think while the case weights are there, their translation, their understanding, the impact on volatility needs to be there. And I think if you give numbers, again, the committee can kind of work on it, but I'm going to say is that people are going to get wed to something. And we're talking about principle-based decisions. And if there's the need to digest and absorb and process, you put a number out there on the 22nd or before that, it's gonna sort of short circuit that conversation.
So the timing of the release of the new workload information, the RAS model, et cetera, was so close to the end of the fiscal year. It just makes sense to give us a glide path to just sort of digest the impact of all of that so that we are in a better positioned in the 627 fiscal year or
I'm looking at it also just from a not just an internal issue but also from an advocacy standpoint and uh-huh. us being able to really defend where we land on all this.
Okay.
Because if we increase the likely increase the need by several $100 million, that is something that we need to really consider internally before we put out something, because those materials will be there for public consumption.
Okay. Thank you, Z. I appreciate it.
Kim, thanks, Judge Getty, Chris, Judge Clark, David, Chad. We've got about 15 minutes left, Judge Getty.
First of all, thank you all for the hard work, Leah. Great stepping in. You always do a fantastic job in Zlatko. Thank you for translating. And I am hearing what you were saying. I am hearing actually very clearly what you were saying. Is it in, and I am very much a numbers person, seeing the result number, because, you know, like many of us, I went into law to get away from math. But I can appreciate that maybe just a statistical difference between the WAFM analysis or the WAFM need and the new RAS need might at least give us an explanation of the difference between the directions without an actual numerical value. Does that make any sense? Because
maybe, example, maybe we, maybe what we'll do is we'll talk about it with Judge Conklin and Leah and Chad and Rebecca about what package we could, because definitely one thing will be there will be the 2017 case rates updated with salaries, with filings, with all of that. That way we definitely will have that. It's my concern about the others. But if there are some other comparative statistics that we can provide that give you a sense of scope just from this sort of initial conversation, we can work on that.
No, I appreciate it. And I know that you're working very hard. It is really hard to get the numbers on the morning of it. And I'm in jury, I'm juggling two jury trials right now.
Right.
And so the more advanced, so that those of us who are numerically challenged can spend some time wallowing it around in it, I appreciate the challenges that it presents. It's a major shift. And, you know, just for example, Solano and Sonoma are very similarly sized, but our caseloads are distinctively different. We have about 7 homicides more per judge, and they have about 7 homicides altogether in their county. So I can appreciate, just using the S counties that I know of that are similarly situated, the difference that this could make. So thank you. Thank you guys for your hard work.
Judge Getty, thank you. Chris?
Yes, thank you, Judge. And this is really just a kind of a long-term process question, and mainly directed maybe to Zlatko and Judge Conklin. And that is, you know, given I understand the recommendation for the next fiscal year will be to maintain the 2017 case weights and try to minimize volatility. Will it be for this committee to make recommendations about the longer term process and, you know, the timing and the how that the 2025 case weights come to be implemented and applied? Is that going to be within this committee's purview?
Yeah. Well, how about this? As we've talked about it in these other instances, the council outside of statute, we write our own rules. We write the, so the workload formula used to be WAFM, right? So Chris, we adapt, we adjust. And so I think that, you know, I think the energy here is for the 24 or the 25, 26 fiscal year and the application of the workload formula data that we used the 2017 case weights. Looking to 26, 27, when we've gone through that very thoughtful process of examination and application and absorption, we would expect, and that would be when we would be using it. So yeah, I mean, you are the drivers of the recommendations to, you know, through FMS to the count, to tick back to JBBC and the council. You know, your good work and thoughts are the ones that you know, generate those policy considerations for the council ultimately.
And don't also just keep in mind that there will be adjustments absent the caseweight adjustments. We're going to be making those annual adjustments that we always make based upon filings, OE&E, salary, benefits, and that's in and of itself going to be impactful. But that's something we anticipate every single year,
right?
And we're prepared for. This is something a little bit different. Judge Clark?
My question was actually more for Leah. Is she still with us?
She is.
Leah, yes. I think in looking at it was slide 18 in the PowerPoint, and, you know, we talk about, you know, Zlatko mentioned like the roadshow, or just the idea of educating people about this process and what's involved. One of the things that just jumps out to me very quickly there is the decline in percentage of case weight value regarding mental health. That is likely to raise a lot of eyebrows. Do you know, are all the increased workload values associated with mental health aversion, mental health court, Are those incorporated into the increased weight given to felonies, or are those included in the category of mental health, in which case, how did we get to go down so much when we just added exponential amounts of complexity to that area?
No, those are all really good questions, and it's probably something I'll have to address offline. We did gather, and I'll circle back to you, we did gather information about all of our weights and what people were seeing in the different weights. It could be as well, and I don't have it on the slide, that we've now established this CARE Act weight, so that's not reflected in this weight. But really good questions, and I will talk to the team about what they have gathered in that area. And as part of that roadshow where we talk to courts, we will be bringing that information to those presentations.
I think that'll be one that you really want to be prepared to address, because that just jumps out to me.
Yeah, Judge Clark, I got to say, I'm not trying to jump on your bandwagon, but I, when I saw the same thing, I thought, wow, considering the work that our specialty courts have been doing lately, that one is, I agree. I'm going to appreciate some efforts to drill down on that, because if the work didn't go there, it went somewhere else. There is an increase. But anyways, David, Judge Clark, thanks for that. David Yamasaki?
Yeah, thank you very much. And let me just kind of jump on that same point. I had the privilege serving on DAC of seeing some of the preliminary results of the study, also the explanation that was provided to the council, which generated a bunch of questions. And we did have the benefit of having some clarity provided by Judge Heinrichs, as Leah had just mentioned. So it has taken a little bit of time for all of us kind of in the family to understand some of the elements. And I'm absolutely delighted to see that there is an acknowledgement and recognition that it is taking us longer to process cases in light of all of the new requirements that have taken place over the years. And one thing that I think is important to remember is that once we are completely understanding of what this new methodology is suggesting, which is going to take a little bit of time, the tool to help us support the needs of the branch will require us to convince those folks in Sacramento. And like the first time out with Waltham, it took a couple of years, hopefully not that long, to educate the folks over there with this methodology. But there's going to be a lot of questions raised, and we're going to have to respond accordingly. And so we ourselves, I think, need to spend a little bit of time understanding it within the court family, because courts are going to be impacted, some positively, some not so. So that is going to require a good understanding of what's behind some of the numbers and the rationale, as well as recognizing the real solution, I think, is to get more funding for the judicial branch. And I think the study is going to show that we do need that. It's going to provide the background information and answer some of the questions that the folks over there are going to be able to recognize and support. So this is something that we have to get it right, quite frankly. Otherwise, there may be a level of scrutiny that is not necessary. So let's spend some time educating ourselves, informing ourselves, answering our own questions, and then kind of build from there and helping the folks over at the state capitol understand what it is that we're pitching.
Excellent point, David. Thank you. I see Chad and then David Slayton. Chad?
Thanks, Judge. I'll be quick. Just because of a couple things I've heard folks say, I thought it might be worth just putting a fine point and making it clear that what I believe we are contemplating then is using all of the new data that we get from DAC, so the new filing, basically running the workload formula using all of the updated data except for the new case weights. So the thought would be that we would still run the workload formula using updated filings and other updated data, but we simply would not apply the new case weights. And I want to make sure everybody understands that, because I thought I heard some comments that suggested, well, we're not going to use any of the new data, but I think what's being suggested is we'll use some of it, but we just won't use the new case weights yet.
That's a point I tried to make, and you just made it much better. That we will see changes, and even this year, we will see changes as we see every year, but you stated it more precisely than I did. Okay. Anything else, Chad? David Slayton?
Judge Conklin, thanks. And thanks for the presentation today. It's very helpful. I know this is an informational item, but I just want to chime in to say that I really appreciate the recommendation that's being made. You know, some of you know that we did a judicial workload study in LA last year. It showed similar, pretty drastic changes in workload. I think this is recognizing the fact that over the last 8 years, even though we've been increasing our, you know, looking at the filings year to year and adjusting workload need based upon that, it has not recognized the increased complexity of the work that's being assigned. And I really appreciate the fact that this is now going to show it. It's just, as Zlatko said, I think it's important to make sure other people understand that outside of the branch, as well as we do who are in the branch side. I think that recommendation to take some time and make sure externally they understand that is really important. And certainly, I think a good recommendation I hope we will follow. The second thing I think is, I do think, you know, who knows where we'll all fall exactly on this, but if we were to make this, take the new weights and put them into effect on May 22nd, we have about 40 days to adjust our budgets. And some of it may be significant, positive or negative. And that just seems like it's moving too fast. I do think the principle of providing some sustainability and stability is really important here. And I think, you know, we won't be harmed by waiting a year to put that in place. And I certainly hope we'll go with that. So I think that recommendation is a really positive one. And I look forward to supporting that when it comes forward. Thanks very much.
Thanks, David. We use the analogy of a glide path, and I think we need a glide path versus a crash landing. I don't know how else to say it. I think I've seen and covered all the hands. Zlatko, do you want to wrap us up with anything?
Thank you for all your comments. Appreciate it very much so. I mean, we will work to what Judge Getty has described about, is are there some comparisons we can provide to help frame the differences without it being, you know, 5 billion versus 7 billion, throwing out, you know, numbers that aren't the numbers, but just the, you know, that kind of thing. But we'll work on that and see what we can do to help sort of enlighten the beginning of the conversation. I know we have a SEAC meeting, the executive committee, in 2 weeks. And so I'm sure that this will be a part of the conversation, folks, because Lee and I were going to be talking about, we might even bore you again and have the similar presentations as we talk about allocations and RAS and case weights. And then we can talk to Daryl about what can be presented there, because that is sort of the beginning, I think, of this, you know, absorption by all. And I know Lee is going to be talking to DAC leadership tomorrow about these things. And her last slide is that this is, there's always an opportunity for revision and based on the input, the good input of the court. So I've said a lot already today. I think I might stop for a moment.
Okay, so I'm just trying to keep us all on time. We got 2 minutes to get to our closed session. I'm going to echo everything everybody just said, Leah, and from DAC and Zlatko, and I'll just tell you folks, the phone calls, the meetings, the everything has been nonstop, is pretty close to accurate. We're not exaggerating here. This is impactful, to say the least. So thank you all, but there's more to come, and we could be in a completely different universe in 2 weeks, because on May 14th we learn new numbers, and hopefully we will stay on this trend. But let's hold on to hold on, and who knows what place the Dodgers will be in by then too. So
yeah, and on that point, it is just, it's honor before the 14th,
right?
I know that they are taking their decision making process right to the very end, so it's unlikely to be earlier than next Wednesday. But if you recall last year, the governor was heading out of town and did a little preview on the Friday before, which threw us all off. I don't expect that this year, but you know, keep your roller skates and your ice blades sharp for whatever might come our way. But assuming that it is on Wednesday, we'll have a phone call. We'll have to generate a quick memo for folks to let y'all know what's in there. Like, for example, we're still advocating for CARE Act, or not CARE Act, but Prop 36 money. And there's another hearing on the topic next week. So it's so there's a lot going on, and we're going to keep you in the loop. And that's it.
Great, thank you. So it's 1:30. What I'm going to do is transition now to the closed meeting. As a closed meeting and following the rules of court, we're going to close the meeting, turn off the recording for the purpose of discussing this closed meeting. Rose, can you do that and confirm that we're no longer being recorded and no longer open?